even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is a Roifield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Barbara. And this week we're talking about one of the biggest stories in the world today, the urbanization of China.
Is what I call the China's new city building movement, which pretty much started, got to start around year 2000 with the beginning of the Go West initiative, which was this massive government project to develop the inland cities of China. Now, what's confusing about this is that they can build a downtown area really, really quickly. 5 years from like a place being farms and villages to having like, you know, an array of 60 skyscrapers, right?
So I have a confession at the start of this, which is I've never actually been to China. I've never got near it. The furthest east I've gone is Dubai, I think, which is a whole different podcast.
Yeah.
but you lived there for a short time, didn't you?
Yes. So I had a slightly strange experience of China compared to other people in that I didn't go on a holiday and then go to lots of cool Chinese cities. I went and I lived in Shanghai for about 2.5 months and worked there and stuff. So it was a slightly bizarre thing where I just went and lived in this massive, massive city and was like, whoa, this is like nowhere I've ever been before. London definitely isn't like this.
So tell us about Shanghai. How did it differ from your experience of cities before?
It's absolutely enormous. Something I really liked about it is that it's a bit like New York in that it's a very specific, it's done basically on a grid system. It might not always look like that on a map, but the way the road signs are done is kind of very clear because you have roads which have west and east or else north and south, and then on every single sign it will tell you kind of which numbers are which way, and there's this kind of acknowledgement in the planning of the city that it's so huge that you need kind of all kinds of help to kind of navigate it. But it is, a lot of it is very brand new. So on one side of the river is something called the Bund, which is a strange panorama of very European looking buildings which were built by European countries in Shanghai while they were there. And then across the river you have this kind of completely different view, which is these insane huge skyscrapers. So there's one called, which people call the Bottle Opener, which has a gap up halfway up just because why not? And then there's something called the Pearl of the Orient, which is this huge, basically a satellite tower with a museum in the basement, which again must be twice as tall as the Shard or something. And this entire financial district was built on marshland in the space of about 10 years, I think. The whole thing, when you come from London, where things were kind of gradually built, mostly a really long time ago, sometimes there's a new skyscraper, it's not very tall, it takes some ages, it's not very good. It's just a completely different scale of development.
I mean, I think that's the sort of the one of the biggest stories in the sort of world of cities, is the rate of urbanization in China. I mean, there's the stat you hear a lot, that particularly if you read City Metric, that, you know, in, they think 2008, for the first time in history, a majority of the world's population lived in cities. Well, the rapid urbanization of China is a pretty big part of that. It wouldn't have happened otherwise. So as recently as you know, the 1960s, it was something like a fifth of the Chinese population were living in cities, and everyone else was basically on a farm somewhere. And then, you know, since the 60s, that's just totally flipped over. And sometime in the last couple of years now, a majority of the Chinese population is urban. And because China is, you know, something like a fifth of the world's population in one country, that's the thing that's really that's had the biggest impact on the urbanization of humanity as a whole, I think.
Yeah. And I think that also, I mean, this is partly to do with obviously the sheer scale of the country. But I mean, in Britain, when we think about urbanization, we think of people moving to urban centres which already exist, and there aren't that many of them, and people again gravitate more towards London sometimes than to smaller northern cities or whatever. In China, what this means is this swelling of cities that you've never heard of, which kind of double in size because people move from their relatively rural area nearby to this urban, what they think of as an urban centre, but which in the scale of the number of Chinese cities is kind of relatively insignificant. But I guess a part of that is, I mean, China actually, for a country that seems to be encouraging rapid moving and rapid urbanisation, has very strict rules on where you can and can't move. So I think that actually, in a way, although Beijing and Shanghai are kind of giant super cities, they aren't as huge and sprawling and horrible as they could be, because actually it's quite hard to move to one of those places if you're not from somewhere nearby, because you have to register and you effectively would have to get a special work visa in order to move there. And the Chinese government's being a bit more lax on this. It's called hukou. It's like your hukou papers are kind of where you're allowed to live. And they're a little bit more relaxed now, but not really. But you can kind of see the benefit in that slightly when you consider that you're getting loads of quite flourishing cities now rather than just two.
I think one of the interesting things about China, which you've already alluded to, is that it's kind of doing urbanization a different way round to the way we're used to. So generally in the West, the city will grow because people move to it.
And then they realize they need to build more houses and panic.
Yeah. Whereas in China, they build the cities and then people arrive. But one slightly odd side effect of that is there's a period where the cities just sit there empty. And they're often reported on in the West as these things called ghost cities. And we know a guy who literally wrote the book on the subject.
Next station is Fuxingmen. Fuxingmen is a transfer station. Passengers for line 2, please prepare to get off. 列车在复兴门站停车时间较短。
Hello, my name is Wade Shepherd. I'm the author of Ghost Cities of China, which is a book that chronicles the 2.5 years I spent traveling to and living in China's new cities, which is more accurately what China's ghost cities are. I first ended up in China in 2005. I was a student at Zhejiang University. And it was around that time when I first started stumbling into China's new urban districts and cities. And it happened completely by accident. I was working on a project about, of all things, China's modern hermit tradition. So I was down in Zhejiang province, out in the mountains, near a small town, a small city called Tiantai. Now near here is where the Tang Dynasty poet Han Shan had his famous hermitage, far from the world of dust. So I was going to go and try to find my way out to it and just write a couple stories about that. I actually ended up being of significance about this trip. Really wasn't anything to do with Chinese hermits, but when I arrived in Tiantai, rather than making a right out of the bus station, I made a left. And I found myself within a matter of moments within this entirely new urban district. Completely new streets, completely new five-story buildings, shop fronts, apartments, everything you can imagine a small city would have, except for people. Now, this was around 2005, 2006 at that time, and this was a few years before the first ghost city report started coming out in the international media, so I had no idea what I was looking at. I've been traveling the world for about 8 years up until that point. Went to about 45, 50 different countries, and I have never been in a city without people before. So I was a little bit enthused. I was quite a bit younger then, probably about 25 years old or so. And with a big burst of what you could call maybe immature enthusiasm, I rushed back to my university and I sat down, went into my professor's office, and I'm telling him about my new great discovery of this city without people, outside of Tiantai in Zhejiang province. And the old distinguished Chinese professor just kind of looked at me and he was like, yeah, those places are everywhere. I just completely stole my thunder, right? So I kind of limped out of his office, whatever, and I kind of forgot about it for a couple of months. But later on that summer, I was hitchhiking up in Inner Mongolia. And I got a ride into this town called Arnholt, Arlian in Chinese, which this place pretty much only has two things. It has a couple giant dinosaurs over the highway leading into town, and it has a border to Mongolia. which is where I was going. But anyway, so I walked down from the highway and into town, and I found myself in another completely new new district without people, building streets. And this is kind of in the desert, so it's kind of like sand dunes kind of like rising up over the abandoned buildings. And if there were tumbleweeds there, there would definitely be tumbleweeds rolling by. At this point, I was like, wow, this is very, very interesting. So I started looking for these places after that. And it was about as challenging as taking a bus out to the outskirts of pretty much any Chinese city, getting off and looking. And I found that my professor was right. These places really are everywhere.
Okay, so the obvious question is, like, who is building these things? Where do they come from?
Is what I call the China's new city building movement, which pretty much started... we pretty much got to start around year 2000 with the beginning of the Go West initiative, which was this massive government project to develop the inland cities of China. Around that time, which is a little bit after a decade and a half after reform and opening, in which China started experimenting with building new cities in the East, international investment, and export internationally. And then all of a sudden, you have these massive new urban centers rising in the east of the country. Very, very successful places, places like Shenzhen, which is a completely new city of skyscrapers and massive, massive city that was built from scratch within 30 years. And then you have like Shanghai and Beijing and Tianjin and these cities of the east that were just racing ahead of the rest of the country. And China kind of realized at this point, if this this situation continued, that they were going to have a very, very imbalanced country. On the eastern seaboard, you're going to have some of the most futuristic and modern and dynamic cities in the world, and the rest of the country is going to be a backwater. And that's really what the case was around the year 2000. So I started this Go West policy, which was pretty much, to speak metaphorically, it was kind of like taking a piece of bread and kind of like spreading peanut butter over the whole thing from like one side to the other. And they wanted to take this kind of spread of urbanization and to kind of push it over the country as evenly as possible. So they intentionally started building a massive infrastructural network. We're talking over 12,000 kilometers of high-speed rail line and subways. They extended the highway network by 60,000 kilometers, and China now has the largest highway network in the world. So they built this frame of infrastructure over the entire country. Now, at this time, they didn't really take population centers into account that much. What they're doing is trying to build this even grid, kind of like providing branches for various cities and smaller towns to develop along and to give them the possibility of development. And part of this program was also creating massive manufacturing areas, logistics zones, and building many completely new cities from scratch. So this initiative was very much backed by the central government. It was basically a government plan. So it was local governments kind of like working with funds from the central government to build literally hundreds of new cities, new districts, and literally thousands of new towns all the way across the country.
It's one thing building a new city. How do you actually go and get people to live there? How do you get an economy there? Is that why so many of these places are standing empty? Because you can't make people move somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Once a larger scale new district is ready for a population. Now this is one of the things that a lot of foreign journalists really didn't get, is that new city building, it's a long-term initiative, it's a long-term project, and most of China's new cities are built on timelines between 20 and 23 years. Now, what's confusing about this is that they can build a downtown area really, really quickly. I mean, we're talking about 5 years from like, you know, a place being farms and villages to it having like, you know, an array of 60 skyscrapers, right? But these places aren't really ready to be population centers yet at first. They have no schools, they have no hospitals, blah, blah, blah. They don't have, you know, proper public transportation. But these things come later. When the municipal government is ready to actually populate these new centers, what they do is they start moving in institutions that they have control over. So we're talking about banks. We're talking about state-owned enterprises. We're talking about universities, especially. Many new districts in China have these massive university towns that bring in, you know, upwards of 100,000 to 250,000 people into these budding new districts. And that kind of like sparks, kind of like ignites this flame of economic activity and starts to get the ball rolling. Now, another major factor is that these new districts are often, they're new, right? And they're kind of built to be places that people, middle upper classes, want to be in. So the property sell very, very quickly, right? For throughout the whole new city building movement, I mean, pretty much every apartment in, you know, a larger scale new city or district would sell immediately. So people are buying these places. And then over time, as a new area starts to develop, people gradually start moving out there. These apartments are bought as either long-term investments or without a plan of moving in anytime soon. A lot of times parents would buy properties for their kids, and you can see them sometimes at the housing shows. The kids are really kids. I mean, they're about as high as your knee, right? So nobody's planning on moving into these places anytime soon when they first buy the property. But as the new cities kind of develop, what you see is more and more people moving in, more and more businesses moving in. But I'll put it this way, in the bigger, more dynamic new cities, you see this. There's many, 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 many smaller ones that aren't as successful and aren't as dynamic. Generally speaking, the movement is rather successful if given enough time.
So when we talk about ghost cities, what we really mean is cities that just aren't quite finished yet.
Yeah, what we're talking about is a phase of development that kind of lasts from the time an initial downtown area is built, which is probably around the 5-year point, to around the 15-year point. So we're talking about like this 10 to 15 year period in between where a new city is like kind of in the middle of the chicken or egg scenario, right? No one's going to move into a new town that has nothing, and businesses aren't going to really move into a place that doesn't have people. But that gradually works itself out in the larger scale.
I mean, obviously, Wei's making it quite clear that these places are everywhere, but bizarrely, the same thing basically happened to me, where I kind of went on a day trip to just a random district that I found on a map of Shanghai, and kind of arrived there and was like, oh, this place isn't really happening yet. And there were just these kind of roads that just went off into the distance with these empty houses, empty shopping centres. It was amazing. But again, I suppose maybe it's filled up now, maybe it isn't. But I guess I'll just keep building them.
Yeah, I mean, you'd imagine that Shanghai is probably a relatively easy place to fill up compared
to
a
exactly.
lot of
them. Yeah,
we should probably do a quick geography lesson's the wrong phrase because we're probably going to get stuff wrong. But before I did this job, I had no idea of the internal geography of China, and I don't know how widespread that ignorance is. Maybe I'm just an idiot. But let's talk about that for a second. So
I think part of it is that actually, if you're talking about urbanism, you need like realistically, you'd actually want to know quite a lot about Chinese cities. But we don't. In most countries, there's not more than one or maybe two cities that are economically or politically significant. But in China, there are lots with very high populations and quite successful industry, and so most people I think don't know about most of those places.
Yeah, so you do get these places, you know, bigger than London, but that they're not household names in the way somewhere like Chicago or Rome or wherever is. Mm-hmm. But let's kind of talk about some of the biggest ones. So in the north, you've got the kind of capital region where you've got Beijing, and you've got Tianjin, which is also about 12 million people or something crazy, but that's just the port city for Beijing. And then further south down the coast, you've got Shanghai, which is Shanghai's the main business city, right? Which
yeah,
is,
the financial side. And also, I think most Western companies that have a base in China definitely have one in Shanghai, if not elsewhere as well. So that's probably the most outward-facing place.
I think it was kind of the creation of Western imperialism, wasn't it, Shanghai?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And in a funny kind of way, it's quite satisfying. It's now been reclaimed as this massive financial centre for China itself, using all the kind of architecture and infrastructure that the West kind of brought, enforced upon it. In the first place.
Yeah, I mean, the West kind of built Shanghai to trade with China, and now China uses Shanghai to trade with the West, so
yeah,
that showed us.
There's a nice symmetry there.
And then much further south, you've got the Pearl River Delta, which is where it's Hong Kong, Guangzhou, which I just mispronounced, cause, but which I think is that's Canton. We historically called it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And then Shenzhen as well, and I mean, Lowe's.
Yeah, there's something like 9 cities that would be, you know, in the top 5 cities in Europe in just this one urban area, which is just crazy.
Yeah.
But something it's worth pointing out is all these places are in the east. They're all quite hard by the Chinese coast. There's a city further inland called Wuhan, which comes up quite a lot in the history of China. I read quite recently because it's where Mao Zedong is from. But Wuhan is consistently referred to as central China, and I looked at it on a map, and it still looks like it's pretty near the coast because, you know, historically China was just what is now like the east and further the country, and, you know, the west is basically empty. So, you know, not only do they have all these cities on a scale that we can't really imagine, they've still got all this land to build on if they wanted to.
I mean, yeah. And I think that there is this perhaps belief on the part of the government that the key is to kind of go west and keep, that they could maybe replicate that success once or even twice again, kind of, as you go across the country.
I think there are parallels with somewhere like the United States, actually, where they talk about the Midwest, but really that's still well into the eastern half of the country. But it's just because historically the core of the US was in the northeastern corner.
Yeah, and that physically that is how you moved as you went across conquering your country. And equally the same. I guess you come from the sea, so
how
it goes.
Yeah. I think there's something similar with Russia as well, where, like, you know, Russia looks enormous, but the historic heartland is really just that kind of western corner, and then the rest of it gets conquered during the course of the last 1,000 years.
Yeah, and obviously you don't want to base a lot of your important stuff on somewhere near a border where you could get invaded from, whereas China is kind of strongest at it.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Furthest point from the rest of Europe and Asia. So obviously China's urbanism project is kind of quite extreme and quite different from things we've seen elsewhere, but I suppose the real question is whether it works. So whether, you mean, we talk about these ghost cities and you get these viral images of these empty towns and stuff, but actually the real test of a ghost city is whether it stays one. So was it actually just a pre-city that will be filled with lots of people? And I think Wade has some interesting things to say on that.
Hype sells, right? So these crazy stories of these empty new cities in China, that gets page views, that gets readers, that gets viewers, that gets social shares. So hype sells. And when you're talking about a country like China that is like doing some things that are just like really incomprehensible, if you just look at it quickly from like a Western perspective, it's a goldmine for kind of hype-based journalism. Now, whether we're talking about China's urbanization movement, China's stock market, China's economy, right, it is a literal gold mine for journalists who are, you know, looking to get like a lot of readers. Now, what we find is when we look at these stories and we really look into the background of it, we look at the historic context and we kind of try to learn you know, China's system of doing things, which is very different than in the West. You can't just, you know, take a Western model of how things work, even the things that we take for granted, right, as being just the normal way that things work, kind of like the economy, and apply it to China, because it's very different. China has its own systems. So when we look at China in context, what we see is something very different than kind of like the hype-based Western view of reporting on the country. And when we talk about China's ghost cities, the first ghost city report came out in 2009. An Al Jazeera reporter, who later on got kicked out of China for her hype-based reporting, who was the first journalist in, like, at that point, the first journalist in 20 years to be kicked out of the country. That gives you an ideal of kind of what she was looking for. She went out to Ordos Kangbashir, and she called the place a ghost city. Now, the problem is she showed up when the city it was 5 years old. You know, she showed up at the five-year point of development, right? That means that, you know, Ordos Kangbashir is a completely new city out in the desert that the government decided to build, right? And she showed up at the five-year point and called it a ghost city. Of course, a new city can't, I mean, it's a new city for 300,000 people. Of course, you can't build a completely new city and populate it within 5 years. That's absolutely ridiculous, right? But anyway, she showed up, took pictures of the empty houses. A lot of them weren't even ready for residents yet. I mean, the place is still a construction site, right? And said, oh, ghost city, you know, this place is built to boost GDP and whatever, right? And that narrative really stuck, because in the Western context, you go into a place, you see it's empty of people, you say, oh, this is a failure, right? Oh, there's nobody living here. This place, you know, is defunct. It's like going to bring China to economic ruin. The local officials are just doing it to promote themselves, which they are to a certain extent, but it's way more complicated than that. There's more to it than that. And now we're at this point where a lot of former ghost cities, or places that were called ghost cities by the international media, like Zhongdong in Zhengzhou, or even the Lujiazui CBD in Shanghai, right? When that place was first built, it was deserted. When it was first appeared to have been built, it was deserted for years. And a lot of like Western journalists, like, oh yeah, China can't build their CBD, whatever, China's going to ruin. But then the local government flipped the switch, moved the banks in. Now the place is like, you know, one of the icons of, you know, global economics. I mean, it has like 99, you know, plus percent capacity. It's filled up, right? And what we see a lot of these former ghost cities filling up with people, filling up with businesses. And what's interesting is that, you know, the kind of dominant mainstream international media doesn't go back and look at these places. Say, oh, wow, you know, this place actually, you know, build up with people. Maybe we were wrong here. What happened? You know, this is like this miracle, this crazy, you know, urbanization movement actually worked here. No, they don't do that. What they do is they go out and they look for the next ghost city, right? And like we have this recent study by Peking University, who used a Baidu big data to kind of like track where people are going in the country, and they found kind of like many new towns that not a lot of people were going to, right? And they use that as a metric for saying that these places are ghost cities. Now, that's an interesting analysis. I'm friends with one of the guys who did this study, and that's a very, very interesting thing to look at. But what they found is the places that they said are ghost cities are places like Nanguan, Kuching, Yuhong, Saihan. Really, really. I mean, these places have like another thing in common from being like new districts that don't have many people going to them is that nobody's ever heard of them before, right? I mean, I've been traveling in China for a decade. I didn't hear of any of these places. You talk to most Chinese people, they can't tell you where, you know, Kuching is, right? I mean, these places are very, very remote, very, very, very marginal, right? And using them is kind of like a lens through which to view China's broader economy is like looking at a place like Ironwood, Michigan, right? To talk about the broader economic well-being of the USA. It's just not a proper metric to make such an analysis. And we look at kind of China's bigger new cities, places like Tianpu, new districts of Wuhan, Nanjing, right? Shenzhen even. I mean, we're talking about some of the most economically dynamic cities in the world now. Right, some of the most successful cities in the world. But a decade ago, about 15 years ago, were unpopulated new districts. So we kind of have this imbalance, an imbalance analysis when we talk about China's new cities. I mean, here's the thing, right? A lot of the places that we take for granted in China today as being, you know, vibrant new cities As I said, 10, 15 years ago, there were ghost cities, right? But you don't get like a notification on your mobile phone when you arrive in one. I mean, there's no sign saying you are now standing on the site of a former ghost city. No, it just looks like normal city, right? It just looks like normal China. And the thing is that, ex-ghost cities aren't news. It's just normal. You see a city full of people, and you just expect that it's always been that way.
Sorry, to an extent, it is normal, isn't it? Because, I mean, reading about the history of China, the number of... Beijing was a planned city that was built as a new capital. I think Nanjing before it. Like so many of the major cities in China today are places that, some governments hundreds of years in the past just decided one day we're going to put a city here. So in some ways, it's just kind of keeping up with that tradition, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very true. Chang'an, Chengdu. Yeah, we're talking about these ancient, planned cities. And it is very, very similar to how China developed all through its history. Now, granted, it's on a much broader and crazier scale, but it's very similar. Like I was reading the other day, kind of like this biography of Joseph Needham, who wrote this, the history of China's like 20 volumes or whatever. But there was like a little excerpt in this book about him reading over kind of like this old, travel manual from these like Portuguese priests who were in China. And they were just marveling at the fact that China was building these very elaborate, very, very expensive, just very, very, at the time, modern bridges out in the middle of nowhere, right? And they just couldn't understand why a country would build such a big, such a grand bridges in the middle of nowhere. And that's really what China is still doing, right? Because the ideal is kind of viewing the country, or as far as I can, imagine, viewing the country as one big organism, right? And if you don't have, the proper connections going through it, I mean, it's not just about building city, building infrastructure and for places that people are, but it's about building building up the country as a whole, as one big plan. And it's really the same today, what China does and also how we view China is, it's very similar. I mean, we still have the same misunderstandings as, Portuguese, missionaries did, 200-300 years ago.
And now it's time for the first of a whole new segment, a whole new interactive segment indeed, in which someone out there in the big wide world is going to tell us about their city. This bit is meant to be interactive, the point will be to hear from you lot, but, this week, as it's the first time we've done it, we thought we'd, as a special treat, we thought we'd let you hear from the man behind the curtain. He's our producer, Royfield Brown.
Hello, my city is Birmingham, which you can probably hear from my South Brummie accent. I've been a Brummie all my life, even though I've spent the last 20 years in London. You can't get the Brum out of the boy. What would I change about my hometown? My hometown fundamentally has many things going for it. Racial diversity, general sense of tolerance, and the fact that it doesn't have the braggadocio-ness of the north of England, but it does have an identity. But what I would change about my hometown fundamentally are the roads. The roads have scarred Birmingham City. And even though the council have made some recognition of the fact that the ring roads around the city centre and the flyovers and the underpasses have kind of scarred development of the city centre and hampered its growth, they haven't and are not doing enough to counteract that. Secondly, landmark buildings. We need less of those and we need more creative zoning of bits of the city centre which are underdeveloped. We need creative zoning of those so that small entrepreneurs, new business owners can go in and actually then create their vision of Birmingham as opposed to a top-down thing whereby we have the biggest library in Western Europe or the biggest shopping centre in Western Europe.
So how, I hear you crying, can I be featured on the City Metric podcast? Well, there are two ways, both of which are pretty low-tech. We do have an account set up with a thing called SpeakPipe. If you Google City Metric SpeakPipe, you should be able to leave a message for us there. That's pretty limited, though. We have very limited disk capacity and it only lets you record 90 seconds at a time. Or you can just record us on your phone and send us that. So if you get in touch, tell us about your city.
So our map of the week this week is very related actually to the subject of ghost cities. I think, as we were kind of saying before, this question of whether they are being filled or not is kind of a bit unclear, and the Chinese government isn't hugely keen on doing vast reports on all the empty cities they've been building.
It's funny because they're normally so transparent.
I know, yeah, yeah, completely out of character. But some researchers from Baidu, which is kind of, it's sort of the equivalent of Google, I suppose, and is used by huge numbers of Chinese people, did quite an interesting piece of research, basically mapping areas where there weren't people doing searches on Baidu, essentially. So what they did was they compared satellite maps, which appeared to show urban areas, and then if there wasn't search traffic coming out of those places, they basically concluded that those were either ghost cities which were under development or just still empty, or else occasionally they thought it might be that this was like a tourist area which was empty at certain times in the year. And yeah, so what they kind of put together this map, and they reckon they found about 50 large-ish urban areas which seemed to be empty. And they kind of admit themselves as some limits to this report, in that obviously there might be areas where there's people with less internet literacy, or there could be kind of other reasons why there's less traffic coming out of certain places. But I think it's still an interesting finding, and it does show that there's a lack of knowledge about this, that kind of people like Wade are some of the only people really keeping tabs on what's going on with these places.
It is just, I mean, Wade has said that, you know, the ghost cities is a misleading term and it's often misunderstood in the West. But nonetheless, it is kind of crazy just to think that you can have these entire cities that are kind of invisible, that, you know, people just don't realise they're there for the most part. But
yeah,
I suppose in 10, 15 years, a lot of these places are going to be populated. They're going to be
And
places
I mean,
we're trading with.
There's kind of an analogous story about the financial crash in Europe, and actually in places like Madrid or Ireland, you've got these housing estates which were built in the boom years and then were never filled. And like with those, the story is these decayed places which were never finished and will never be populated. So I think the economy is quite an important story here as well, that if China continues to rapidly urbanise and be quite economically successful, I think these places won't be stories of disaster, but it only takes the scales to tip for that to kind of change. And I think what's interesting as well, so the Baidu research is quite funny, because they only reveal the names of 20 of these places because they don't want to basically threaten the real estate company's chances of selling the other ones to people, because obviously once something's called a ghost city, it calls to mind kind of derelict buildings and stuff, which isn't necessarily true, that there aren't photos in China coming out of these unfinished falling down estates by any means. They're just places that are still empty, so there is a kind of stigma attached to that, and you wonder if us talking about it all the time might actually make it harder for them to fill them.
Well, assuming,
sorry if so.
Yeah, assuming we haven't accidentally crashed the world economy, then we'll be back in 2 weeks. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Elledge and Barbara Speed and produced by Royfield Brown. Our theme music is Dust from the Stars by Charlie Charles. You also heard The Weather by Destinazione Altrove and Embryonic Waves, composed by Matthew Reitzel. All music in the show was licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast and on iTunes, where you'll also find two more shows by our excellent colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps and geography you could possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. You can also talk to us on Twitter and on Facebook, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. And if you wanted to leave a review to tell your friends how lovely we are, well, we'd very much appreciate that. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하 서울역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명동.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.